as he shoots a straight left to the head, and Pruden delivers a left to the head and takes a hard right to the head, another left to the face, a right to the head, all by Ike Williams with 1 minute to go here in round six. There's a right to the head by Williams as he bounces off the rope. Another right to the face by Williams, but he takes a hard left to the midsection, two hard left to the midsection. There's a right to the body and a left to the side of the head now by Ike. Another left to the face by Pruden, whose face is really a mess now from that blood. There's a left to the face now by Pruden, another right to the head by Williams, another left hook to the side of the head by Williams. That staggered Christie for just a moment. Two straight lefts to the face now by Williams, but he takes two hard lefts in the face in return. 30 seconds to go in this round at the stadium between Ike Williams and Fitzy Pruden in a mighty exciting battle, one of the best of the year. A left and a right to the face now by Williams. Two straight lefts to the face by Fitzy Pruden. And Williams gives a little ground, but as he does so, he punishes his opponent very severely with rights and lefts to the face and the nose and the eye. Now they're out in the center. McGarity, the referee, hasn't had much to do in the way of pulling him apart in clinches tonight. There's only been one clinch I can remember in this fight so far. A left to the face and a right to the head by Williams. A straight left to the face now by Pruden. Another exchange of hard lefts to the face on the part of both men. And gee, these guys are really gory at this point. What a lot of punishment they've given and taken. And there's the bell. An exchange of rights to the face as the bell ends round six.
Well, it's only a matter of moments before we switch you to the White House to hear the President of the United States. But Pabst Blue Ribbon has been happy to bring you as much of this fight as was possible, and it's been a spectacular bout. Fitzy Pruden, although he seems to be badly damaged, has been staying in there and mixing it with lightweight champion Ike Williams from the opening gong. How much longer this fight can go if Williams can keep on sharpshooting away at that cut right eye of Fitzy Pruden's is extremely questionable. Williams himself received a cut eye back in the third round, but that one has apparently weathered the storm. It is giving Ike Williams no apparent trouble as we conclude round number six and are waiting for round number seven to begin. Fitzy Pruden has stayed in there, however, has had no difficulty with the injury as yet, and will be, of course, answering the bell for round number seven. There is the warning buzzer. Here again, Jack Brickhouse.
We'll take as much as we can. Don't forget your local station. We'll give you the result of the fight after the president's speech. Here we go. Round seven now. Ike Williams and Fitzy Pruden. They're out in the center of the ring. The boys are circling. There's two straight lefts to the face, a left to the nose now by Williams. All light blows. Those eyes, of course, have been closed, but they'll start to bleed any second now. There's a left to the side of the head by Williams.
Ladies and gentlemen, we regret that we are unable to bring you the remainder of tonight's fight. The decision will be announced immediately following President Truman's message to the nation. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is KOOK in Billings. New quarters for the Butte Field Office of the U.S. Department of Commerce were opened last week at 306 Federal Building Butte. The new offices replaced those formerly located at 14 West Granite Street and provide additional facilities to handle the increased volume of National Production Authority business. W.G. Maloney, district manager, stated that matters arising over priorities, allocations, and compliance, and other interpretations of NPA orders and regulations will continue to be handled through the new offices.
From the White House in Washington, D.C., CBS presents an address by President Harry S. Truman. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I want to talk to you plainly tonight about what we're doing in Korea and about our policy in the Far East. In the simplest terms, what we're doing in Korea is this. We're trying to prevent a third world war. I think most people in this country recognized that fact last June, and they warmly supported the decision of the government to help the Republic of Korea against the communist aggressors. Now, many persons, even some who applauded our decision to defend Korea, have forgotten the basic reason for our action. It is right for us to be in Korea now. It was right last June, it is right today. I want to remind you why this is true. The communists in the Kremlin are engaged in a monstrous conspiracy to stamp out freedom all over the world. If they were to succeed, the United States would be numbered among their principal victims. It must be clear to everyone that the United States cannot and will not sit idly by and await foreign conquest. The only question is, what is the best time to meet the threat, and how is the best way to meet it? The best time to meet the threat is in the beginning. It is easier to put out a fire in the beginning when it is small than after it has become a roaring blaze. And the best way to meet the threat of aggression is for the peace-loving nations to act together. If they don't act together, they are likely to be picked off one by one. If they had followed the right policies in the 1930s, if the free countries had acted together to crush the aggression of the dictators, and if they had acted in the beginning, when the aggression was small, there probably would have been no World War II. If history has taught us anything, it is that aggression anywhere in the world is a threat to the peace everywhere in the world. When that aggression is supported by the cruel and selfish rulers of a powerful nation who are bent on conquest, it becomes a clear and present danger to the security and independence of every free nation. This is a lesson that most people in this country have learned thoroughly. This is the basic reason why we have joined in creating the United Nations. And since the end of World War II, we've been putting that lesson into practice. We've been working with other free nations to check the aggressive designs of the Soviet Union before they can result in a third world war. That is what we did in Greece when that nation was threatened by aggression of international communists. The attack against Greece could have led to general war, but this country came to the aid of Greece. The United Nations supported Greek resistance. With our help, the determination and efforts of the Greek people defeated the attack on the spot. Another big communist threat to peace was the Berlin blockade. That too could have led to war. But again, it was settled because free men would not back down in an emergency. Their aggression against Korea is the boldest and most dangerous move the communists have yet made. The attack on Korea was part of a greater plan for conquering all of Asia. I would like to read to you from a secret intelligence report which came to us after the attack on Korea. I have that report right here. It is a report of a speech a communist army officer in North Korea gave to a group of spies and saboteurs last May, 1 month before South Korea was invaded. The report shows in great detail how this invasion was a part of a carefully prepared plot. Here, in part, is what the communist officer who had been trained in Moscow told his men. Our forces, he said, are scheduled to attack South Korean forces about the middle of June. The coming attack on South Korea marks the first step toward the liberation of Asia. Notice that he used the word liberation. This is communist double talk, meaning conquest. I have another secret intelligence report here. This one tells what another communist officer in the Far East told his men several months before the invasion of Korea. And here's what he said. In order to successfully undertake the long-awaited world revolution, we must first unify Asia, Java, Indochina, Malaya, India, Tibet, Thailand, Philippines, and Japan are our ultimate targets. The United States is the only obstacle on our road for the liberation of all the countries in Southeast Asia. In other words, we must unify the people of Asia and crush the United States. Again, liberation in commie language means conquest. That's what the communist leaders are telling their people, and that is what they've been trying to do. They want to control all Asia from the Kremlin. This plan of conquest is in flat contradiction to what we believe. We believe that Korea belongs to the Koreans. We believe that India belongs to the Indians. We believe that all the nations of Asia should be free to work out their affairs in their own way. This is the basis of peace in the Far East, and it is the basis of peace everywhere else. The whole communist imperialism is back of the attack on peace in the Far East. It was the Soviet Union that trained and equipped the North Koreans for aggression. The Chinese Communist massed 44 well-trained and well-equipped divisions on the Korean frontier. These were the troops they threw into battle when the North Korean Communists were beaten. The question we have had to face is whether the communist plan of conquest can be stopped without a general war. Our government and other countries associated with us in the United Nations believe that the best chance of stopping it without a general war is to meet the attack in Korea and defeat it there. That is what we have been doing. It is a difficult and bitter task, but so far it has been successful. So far we have prevented World War III. So far, by fighting a limited war in Korea, we have prevented aggression from succeeding and bringing on a general war. And the ability of the whole free world to resist communist aggression has been greatly improved. We've taught the enemy a lesson. He has found that aggression is not cheap or easy. Moreover, men all over the world who want to remain free have been given new courage and new hope. They know now that the champions of freedom can stand up and fight, and that they will stand up and fight. Our resolute stand in Korea is helping the forces of freedom now fighting in Indochina and other countries in that part of the world. It has already slowed down the timetable of conquest. In Korea itself, there are signs that the enemy is building up his ground forces for a new mass offensive. We also know that there have been large increases in the enemy's available air forces. If a new attack comes, I feel confident it will be turned back. The United Nations fighting forces are tough and able and well equipped. They are fighting for a just cause. They are proving to all the world that the principle of collective security will work. We are proud of all these forces for the magnificent job they have done against heavy odds. We pray that their efforts may succeed, for upon their success may hinge the peace of the world. The communist side must now choose its course of action. The communist rulers may press the attack against us. They may take further action which will spread the conflict. They have that choice, and with it the awful responsibility for what may follow. The communists also have the choice of a peaceful settlement, which could lead to a general relaxation of the tensions in the Far East. The decision is theirs, because the forces of the United Nations will strive to limit the conflict if possible. We do not want to see the conflict in Korea extended. We are trying to prevent a world war, not to start one. And the best way to do that is to make it plain that we and the other free countries will continue to resist the attack. But you may ask, why can't we take other steps to punish the aggressor? Why don't we bomb Manchuria and China itself? Why don't we assist the Chinese nationalist troops to land on the mainland of China? If we were to do these things, we would be running a very grave risk of starting a general war. If that were to happen, we would have brought about the exact situation we're trying to prevent. If we were to do these things, we would become entangled in a vast conflict on the continent of Asia, and our task would become immeasurably more difficult all over the world. What would suit the ambitions of the Kremlin better than for our military forces to be committed to a full-scale war with Red China? It may well be that in spite of our best efforts, the communists may spread the war. But it would be wrong, tragically wrong, for us to take the initiative in extending the war. The dangers are great. Make no mistake about it. Behind the North Koreans and the Chinese communists, in the front line stand additional millions of Chinese soldiers. And behind the Chinese stand the tanks, the planes, the submarines, the soldiers, and the scheming rulers of the Soviet Union. Our aim is to avoid the spread of the conflict. The course we have been following is the one best calculated to avoid an all-out war. It is the course of consistent with our obligation to do all we can to maintain international peace and security. Our experience in Greece and Berlin shows that it is the most effective course of action we can follow. First of all, it is clear that our efforts in Korea can blunt the will of the Chinese communists to continue the struggle. The United Nations forces have put up a tremendous fight in Korea and have inflicted very heavy casualties on the enemy. Our forces are stronger now than they have been before. These are plain facts which may discourage the Chinese communists from continuing their attack. Second, the free world as a whole is growing in military strength every day. In the United States, in Western Europe, and throughout the world, free men are alert to the Soviet threat and are building their defenses. This may discourage the communist rulers from continuing the war in Korea and from undertaking new acts of aggression elsewhere. If the communist authorities realize that they cannot defeat us in Korea, if they realize it would be foolhardy to widen the hostilities beyond Korea, then they may recognize the folly of continuing their aggression. A peaceful settlement may then be possible. The door is always open. Then we may achieve a settlement in Korea which will not compromise the principles and purposes of the United Nations. I have thought long and hard about this question of extending the war in Asia. I have discussed it many times with the ablest military advisors in the country. I believe with all my heart that the course we are following is the best course. I believe that we must try to limit the war to Korea for these vital reasons: to make sure that the precious lives of our fighting men are not wasted, to see that the security of our country and the free world is not needlessly jeopardized, and to prevent a third world war. A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy. It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders. But the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual. The change in commands in the Far East means no change whatever in the policy of the United States. We will carry on the fight in Korea with vigor and determination in an effort to bring the war to a speedy and successful conclusion. The new commander, Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway, has already demonstrated that he has the great qualities of military leadership needed for this task. We are ready at any time to negotiate for a restoration of peace in the area. But we will not engage in appeasement. We're only interested in real peace. Real peace can be achieved through a settlement based on the following factors. One, the fighting must stop. Two, concrete steps must be taken to ensure that the fighting will not break out again. Three, there must be an end to the aggression. A settlement founded upon these elements would open the way for the unification of Korea and the withdrawal of all foreign forces. In the meantime, I want to be clear about our military objective. We are fighting to resist an outrageous aggression in Korea. We are trying to keep the Korean conflict from spreading to other areas. But at the same time, we must conduct our military activities so as to ensure the security of our forces. This is essential if they are to continue the fight until the enemy abandons this ruthless attempt to destroy the Republic of Korea. That is our military objective: to repel attack and to restore peace. In the hard fighting in Korea, we are proving that collective action among nations is not only a high principle, but a workable means of resisting aggression. Defeat of aggression in Korea may be the turning point in the world's search for a practical way of achieving peace and security. The struggle of the United Nations in Korea is a struggle for peace. Free nations have united their strength in an effort to prevent a third world war. That war can come if the communist rulers want it to come. But this nation and its allies will not be responsible for its coming. We do not want to widen the conflict. We will use every effort to prevent that disaster. And in so doing, we know that we are following the great principles of peace, freedom, and justice.
You have just heard an address by the President of the United States speaking to you from his office at the White House in Washington, D.C. This broadcast has come to you through the CBS Department of Public Affairs. We return you now to New York.
Just concluded. In tonight's fight at Chicago Stadium between lightweight champion Ike Williams and Fitzy Pruden, Ike Williams won in a hard-fought 10-round bout. The decision, unanimous.
From NBC's correspondents, here again is Morgan Beatty.
Somewhere tomorrow, Tokyo time, over the Sea of Japan, General Matthew B. Ridgway's three-star plane is heading for the capital of Japan. Or maybe he's landed by now, Thursday morning, Japanese time. The frontline general, who wears grenades taped to his shoulders, left the command posts of North Korea with obvious regret, but not a word would he say. The GIs on the front lines were astounded at the new turn of events. They said, most of them, that they couldn't understand it. One sergeant said, "I hate to see us lose a good man like Mac." Another one countered this way, "Ridgway ought to do all right. I've never heard anything but good about him." Still another soldier shrugged his shoulders and said, "Okay, maybe it's time for a change. I hear Ridgway is a fat positive." A fat positive is airman's slang for the opposite of a negative. A fat positive is a fine man and a fighting man. In Tokyo, the general who has been stripped of his command pondered in the secrecy of his headquarters, pondered his future course. He knows from the president's own words that he, General MacArthur, will not be bound to keep his mouth shut. President Truman made it clear, abundantly clear, the general, even though he is still subject to presidential orders, may go where he pleases, say what he pleases. General MacArthur could hardly misunderstand that. It's a fight, if he wants to make it one, over global policy of the United States government. Here in Washington, Republicans in the Senate and House rallied together to help the general make his fight, to canvass possibilities. Some of them talked, and talked loud, for impeachment of the president and Secretary of State Dean Acheson. Wiser counsel suggested other courses of action. But all of them were agreed they wanted to hear the MacArthur story from the general himself. And a full-dress Republican meeting will be held Monday next to see if the various elements of the party can agree. Trouble is, many powerful Republicans do not support the MacArthur idea of expanding the war in Asia. In the past, that has meant Dewey, Warren, Dulles, Duff, all powerful men, Saltonstall, Lodge, Massachusetts. Some of them today supported the president on the ground that we have a civil government and national policy should not be dictated by a general. But any way you look at it, a fight is in the making, and General MacArthur seems to be getting ready to come back home to lead it. He's told his friends, and that's backed up by his public statements, that he feels the United Nations forces could lick the Red Chinese armies and thus destroy the power of the Red government of China, as we have reported to you before. But he admits this means expanding the war in Asia. He has used that word himself. Expanding it either by bombing Red China's bases, blockading Red China, or using Chinese nationalist troops from Formosa. In short, he's pondering whether to spark a drive for victory in Korea rather than a limited and inconclusive military action that has no ending in sight. President Truman will take the other side of that argument. In fact, if you've been listening to the radio tonight, you know that he has welcomed the fight and he has struck the first blow for his own presidential policy. That argument the president summarized tonight in as simple and plain a speech as he could possibly make. He showed by the way he made his points that he realizes the GI in Korea, the housewife in Seattle, the Teamster in Hoboken, they don't yet realize that a big global decision is involved in this situation. Remember the president's main argument that he made a few minutes ago, that our efforts now, officially, are to limit the war in Korea. If you're hazy on the point, here are his own words and his voice.
"We do not want to see the conflict in Korea extended. We are trying to prevent a world war, not to start one. And the best way to do that is to make it plain that we and the other free countries will continue to resist the attack. But you may ask, why can't we take other steps to punish the aggressor? Why don't we bomb Manchuria and China itself? Why don't we assist the Chinese nationalist troops to land on the mainland of China? If we were to do these things, we would be running a very grave risk of starting a general war. If that were to happen, we would have brought about the exact situation we're trying to prevent. If we were to do these things, we would become entangled in a vast conflict on the continent of Asia, and our task would become immeasurably more difficult all over the world. What would suit the ambitions of the Kremlin better than for our military forces to be committed to a full-scale war with Red China. It may well be that in spite of our best efforts, the communists may spread the war. But it would be wrong, tragically wrong, for us to take the initiative in extending the war.
That's the Truman argument, and the president also made it plain that the nation owes a debt of gratitude to MacArthur the general. But policy is formed by the government in Washington, and the general, in the president's view, is not on the team. He doesn't agree with that policy.
A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy. It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders. But the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
And finally, the president made public the minimum terms we offer for world peace or peace in the Orient. It's the peace ultimatum we told you about in the works before MacArthur personally intervened with his own terms for peace. The president named the terms 1, 2, 3. Order.
1, the fighting must stop. 2, concrete steps must be taken to ensure that the fighting will not break out again. 3, there must be an end to the aggression. A settlement founded upon these elements would open the way for the unification of Korea and the withdrawal of all foreign forces.
And that's the president's position. We'll hear from General MacArthur later. Meanwhile, across the nation, across the world, public opinion is beginning to form, to progress from the first explosive, disbelieving reaction to a solid thinking period. Here's a sample from the West Coast to Los Angeles and Elmer Peterson.
It's too early for any reaction out here to President Truman's radio address, but judging by editorial comment to be published on the West Coast tomorrow morning, Mr. Truman's explanations about General MacArthur will be both scorned and accepted. For example, the Oregon Statesman at Salem will say tomorrow that the first duty of a soldier is to obey. The Oregon Journal at Portland says that General MacArthur asked for it. But the Seattle Post-Intelligencer will say tomorrow morning that the dismissal of General MacArthur has, quote, worsened our peculiar and strategic situation in the Far East, unquote. While the Los Angeles Times will say, quote, the most powerful nation in the world now has listened to the mewlings of the impotent allies and has thrown in with the appeasers, unquote. Many Americans, the Times will say, clearly feel their country has been sold out. At Pasadena, California, Fred Runyon, editor of the Pasadena Independent, thinks our reaction depends on whether it's a case of a militarist preempting power or another petulant outburst in Washington. But he has written, if all this represents the grim grand finale of an American public too apathetic to vote itself capable leadership and too indolent to consolidate its greatest and most costly victory, then, he writes, we are desperate. The San Francisco Chronicle will be outstanding tomorrow by virtue of no editorial comment, for the reason, it says, that it wants a day or two to think things over. It hopes its readers may see some virtue in that attitude. This is Elmer Peterson in Los Angeles.
And what of the world beyond our shores, the United Nations, Britain, France, elsewhere, to New York and W.W. Chapman?
The international reaction to the MacArthur dismissal is as mixed as it is at home. At the United Nations headquarters here, it was seen as heralding a possible break in the stalemate in Korea. In London, Foreign Secretary Morrison hinted a new bid to Red China for a ceasefire in Korea may swiftly follow. In France, the price of gold fell, and opinion varied whether peace had been brought closer or was further removed. Berlin, mixed comment, pro and con. Belgium, the conservative newspaper La Nation Belge, says the chief of the American nation has done right. Cairo, a member of the ruling Waftist party, says chances of peace are improved. Copenhagen, says the Aftonbladet, removal of MacArthur will be received with extraordinary relief. Manila, President Quirino invited MacArthur to come for a rest. The country and the people you liberated, he said, would love to have you with us. Moscow, no comment. This is W.W. Chaplin in New York.
And now, around the world, in a minute and a quarter, Tokyo, Thursday morning dateline, on the warfront, Allied forces slog slowly ahead on the rain-swept Korean battle area. News of General MacArthur's dismissal spread like wildfire. Chinese and Korean Red Resistance toughened on the Western and Central fronts, Heavy rains, low overcast, virtually stripped United Nations ground troops of air support. These were the mid-April rains, which frontline officers expect will signal a massive red counteroffensive. Meanwhile, in Washington, an army spokesman says 18 new Chinese red divisions have been identified in Korea since last Friday, bringing to more than 695,000 the total communist strength. Overall red strength was estimated at 470,000 Chinese, 212,000 North Koreans, 13,000 guerrillas. Washington, draft boards throughout the nation were ordered today to hold up the inductions planned for May and to wait for a new decision on how many men are to be called up. The aim is to avoid any mix-up, the one that took place in April, for example, when the Army reduced its draft from 80,000 to 40,000 calls. I'll be back in a moment with more news. Now, here's Tom Moore.
Alka-Seltzer. First, fast, and always. Friends, if you have a cold and your throat's raw and raspy, do this if you want pleasant relief. Dissolve 2 Alka-Seltzer tablets in a quarter glass of warm water, then gargle. See how fast you feel better. How pleasantly Alka-Seltzer helps soothe your irritated throat. There's nothing quite like Alka-Seltzer, and to relieve the feverish ache all over misery of your cold, drink a glass of sparkling Alka-Seltzer, too. Yes, for relief for the miseries of a cold, it's Alka-Seltzer. Now here again is Morgan Beatty.
And here are signs of our times, beginning with a bulletin. Tokyo, Thursday morning dateline. General Douglas MacArthur has made up his mind. He no longer ponders. He definitely will come to the United States as soon as possible. That's a report from informed sources at his headquarters. His departure is undetermined. Sources report that MacArthur naturally is anxious to leave as soon as he can. He expects to be accompanied by Mrs. MacArthur and their 13-year-old son, Arthur. Arthur has never seen the United States. He was born in Manila. Major General Courtney B. Whitney and Mrs. Whitney also are expected to leave with General MacArthur. General Whitney is MacArthur's right-hand man. He announced today that he will resign from the Army in order to accompany his chief back to the United States. Incidentally, there are reports in Washington that the Statler Hotel has a reservation for General MacArthur April 20. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, may I, as an old reporter long on the firing line, pay tribute to my colleague, the Dean of Washington Commentators, Earl Godwin. It was he who beat the world...